Hello, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, where I get to talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Today, I'm coming to you from the Cecil B. Day Chapel at the Carter Center, and I'm fortunate to be joined by three notable guests, co-authors of Andrew Young and the Making of Modern Atlanta, Ambassador Andrew Young, former two-term mayor, congressman and key aide to Martin Luther King Jr., the project creator Andrea Young, an attorney, public policy advocate, and professor of practice at Georgia State University, who happens also to be his daughter, and special advisor to the project, Harvey Newman, professor emeritus in the Department of Public Management and Policy at Georgia State University. Andrea, I'm going to start with you, if you don't mind. I've read many books about Atlanta and consider myself kind of an expert on the subject. But this book, The Making of Modern Atlanta, is really an interesting projection of Atlanta that kind of reveals its recipe for success and some fascinating facts that I didn't know. So the vision for this project itself really was yours. It was your baby, it was your concept, you raised the money, you helped to the supervision and film production, script writing, and so forth. Of course, your father supported you, and you had a special advisor in Harvey, but this was really your baby, as they say. So really, exactly what was your vision, and why were you compelled to create the Making of Modern Atlanta project?
Thank you for that. Well, you know, Atlanta is a very special place, and I have spent many years of my career away, and I came back, and I was part of the Leadership Atlanta class of 2008. And we had in that class people from all walks of life, mid-career leaders in Atlanta. My dad and Sam Williams, who I think is here today, were talking about these sort of iconic stories of Atlanta. You know, how Ivan Allen testified for the Civil Rights Act, how Atlanta had the first interracial formal dinner in the South to honor Dr. King when he won the Nobel Prize. My classmates looked so confused. They said, "We don't know any of this." And so I said, we've got to write these stories down. We've got to get the inside story from the people who made it happen so that this generation and the next generation will come. And Atlanta, because of this leadership, including, of course, the leadership of the amazing Maynard Jackson, 100,000 people a year come to metropolitan Atlanta. They don't know what the secret sauce is. And so if we don't know the sauce, we're not going to keep baking the recipe the right way.
Very good.
The Atlanta Project, the Making of Modern Atlanta Project, really is composed not just of this book, Andrew Young and the Making of Modern Atlanta, but also a film and a digital archive of some of the influential mm-hmm. people that you've interviewed. That's fantastic. And throughout all of this, the film version, the archives, and the book, there's an ongoing theme, the Atlanta Way. And it's a theme that really has specific components. It's not just an empty slogan. So define precisely, if you will, what is the Atlanta Way?
Well, you know, the Atlanta Way is to, you know, there's one way my dad puts it, which is really you have to have everybody be a part of the solution. Everyone has to be a part of making good things happen. If you don't, if you leave anybody out, they'll try to mess it up. So that's one succinct way. But in doing all the interviews, and Harvey and I interviewed over 60 leaders that have been really a key part of making this city grow. And some of the things that sort of emerge from that is really understanding the core competencies, because a city has to have an economic base. So for us, that's transportation. You know, a city, our city, we have to have a governing coalition. In our city, that coalition has held black mayors, white, you know, we from Hartsfield to the present day, we've had a core governing coalition that keeps the same vision. Mark Morial said, you know, in New Orleans, when we change mayors, people would change priorities. In Atlanta, if the vision is to build MARTA, here we are, we got a MARTA referendum. You know, we're still working on that MARTA vision that that Sam Massel got passed, you know, in the late 60s. So the quality of your elites matter. So leadership in this city, we have been so fortunate to have people, you know, people like a Robert Woodruff put their money where their mouth is. People like the John Wesley Dobbs who raised, you know, who's still having an impact on this city from the legacy there. So the quality of your leadership, and then also you use the opportunities for economic growth to expand the pie. So whether it was the Olympics, whether it was the airport, we expanded the pie when we had an opportunity to grow the economy. And then the fifth is that you have to sustain the coalition through mentoring. And so again, in Atlanta, we've had super mentors, Ted Turner, Jesse Hill, Herman Russell, Andrew Young, Ivan Allen, people who's John Portman, people who have mentored second and third generate tiers of leaders that continue to produce great results for our city.
Can I? Sure. You know, one of the things that the book points out that was new to me was that this goes all the way back to Henry Grady.
That was my next question.
but Henry, go ahead and take it. You know, Henry Grady and the Du Bois and Booker T. Washington dialogue and debate that came here, and we've really had some great people that really made, I don't know whether they were sacrifices or they were visions. I say that, you know, for Dr. Mays to raise Maynard Jackson, because Maynard was 15 right. when he went
14.
To 14 when he went to Morehouse, yes. and his thinking of sending him and Martin Luther King up to Connecticut to work on shade grown tobacco, which is a miserable job. You crawling in the dirt, you know, under a 4-foot net in 90-degree heat. And Dr. Mays felt that if you were going to lead working people, you had to have an appreciation of work. And so he didn't send everybody to Connecticut, but he picked out those who were, that he thought had leadership potential, and he sent them to crawl in the dirt.
You mentioned Henry Grady, and I was just going to ask you, Harvey, maybe you or Andrea, the early history, we're talking 19th century now, okay? The early history did show, I was going to say trend, but I think I'll change it to hint, a hint of tolerance in Atlanta among the races. Was there a decade or a certain period or area where there was a tipping point where things became more of a tolerant city?
One of the ways I would answer that is to recall that in 1906, we had a terrible low point in race relations in our city with the Atlanta race riot. An event that was largely forgotten by many in the city until we approached the centennial observance of that event. But in looking back in the aftermath of that event, there began a dialogue between well-educated white folks and well-educated African Americans that led to some ongoing conversations that in some instances continue until today. And that dialogue out of that tragic event helped set a new course toward more tolerant. Now, there were rocky steps along the way, but we certainly began something after September 1906.
I would say if I were to identify a tipping point, I think it was the response. I think at that time, Ivan Allen was chair of the Chamber of Commerce. And the response of our Chamber of Commerce to the student sit-ins, to the challenge of segregation, was so markedly different than what happened in Birmingham, what happened in Louisiana. And so our chamber met, in fact, I think in the old Chamber of Commerce building that had just opened up, and I think Ivan Allen had some secret meetings and sort of integrated the chamber before anyone knew it had been integrated, having meetings to come up with a solution to the gradual integration of Atlanta.
But just so people don't think it was automatic, the students at the AU Center sat down and wrote a manifesto.
Yes, which is in the book.
But it's also, it was published by the presidents of the colleges on a full page ad in the Constitution Journal. So that it was approached in a disciplined, scholarly way. I think you had that coming from both sides.
In the book, I believe it was Clarence Stone that quotes you as saying, "Politics doesn't control the world, money does." And you said, "My job as mayor is to see that whites get some of the power and blacks get some of the money." You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, because I'd rather say that everybody had to be at the table. And Sam Massell, for instance, brought in the poorest of the poor into the MARTA coalition. Because if he had not reduced the bus fare from 55 cents to 15 cents, because the poor knew that the sales tax was regressive. Now, how did they know that? Ivan Allen and Beaufort Jones in the Economic Opportunity Atlanta had organized poor people block by block and had discussions with them. And I mean, it was a miracle because Daddy King and Calvin Craig of the Ku Klux Klan were all on that executive committee. I think Zenona Clayton is probably the only person left who was there. She says she was a little bitty girl, but that's it was courageous coming together. That I give Coca-Cola a lot of credit for, because J. Paul Austin was in South Africa when they started apartheid, and he's from LaGrange, so there was nothing particularly liberal about him. But he knew that what happened in South Africa would be bad if it happened here. And so he came back, I think, determined that, and I think out of that debate and discussion, you got the city too busy to hate. I always say that that was a woman's idea. There was a lady by the name of Helen Bullard who worked on everybody's campaign and stayed in the background, she was brilliant would come up with all kinds of innovative things. And the important thing was that people like Mr. Woodruff listened to her. So we've had a very interesting set of relationships.
You mentioned Woodruff. One of the key elements in this also has been the philanthropy. Harvey, would you talk about that a little bit? How important and what role did that play?
One of the things that has been a hallmark of Mr. Woodruff especially was his desire to make this city special. One of the best quotes about him in the book is that he wanted everything that he touched to be well done. And that began first and foremost with the Coca-Cola Company, but it also extended to the city of Atlanta as well. And so whenever there was a crisis in this city, during the Great Depression, the city couldn't make its payroll. The Coca-Cola company paid the employees until the city could raise enough revenue to pay them back. So he was willing to step forward at whatever opportunity presented itself in order to better the city. And one of those areas that he saw a critical need was in the area of higher education and education in general, as well as the arts. And so the Woodruff Foundation became major supporters of those activities in the city of Atlanta. How many university libraries are named for Mr. Woodruff, all of which took the name after he passed on because he wanted to be the great anonymous donor.
I think one of the most touching stories about Robert Woodruff and the Coca-Cola company was when Dr. King was assassinated, and that Ivan Allen was told, I think that Mr. Woodruff was with Lyndon Johnson when the call came in, and that Dr. King had been assassinated, and he sent word to Ivan Allen that you have my checkbook, whatever you need to do. So when he went to see Mrs. King, he knew that the city had the resources to make sure that his funeral was handled in a way that befitted one of our greatest citizens.
You are listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. This program was recorded at the Carter Center, where I was speaking with Ambassador Andrew Young, his daughter, Dr. Andrea Young, and Professor Emeritus Dr. Harvey Newman, all of whom collaborated to create the documentary and accompanying book, The Making of Modern Atlanta. We'll be back after this short break. This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation, today with Ambassador Andrew Young, his daughter Andrea Young, and Professor Harvey Newman, who all collaborated on the documentary and book project, Andrew Young and the Making of Modern Atlanta. I had the pleasure of talking with our esteemed guest at the Carter Center, where we recorded our interview before an attentive audience. Let's rejoin that conversation. Ivan Allen, a great man, one of my favorite mayors. That 1964 testimony for the Civil Rights Act, how much difference do you think that made in Atlanta?
It made an enormous difference. Dr. King, Ivan Allen, and others had been working behind the scenes with the student movement leaders to try and desegregate the city voluntarily. But the voluntary desegregation agreements for restaurants and hotels and so on did not hold. And so when the call came from President Kennedy, would you come to Washington and testify for a public law that would make it the law of the land across the nation, prohibiting anyone engaged in interstate commerce from acting in a discriminatory fashion? And so Allen, in an act of what I've always called great political courage, went to Washington and testified before arch segregationists like Strom Thurmond, who literally grilled him about why he favored this legislation. And with Lyndon Johnson's ability as a leader, this was able to pass Congress and eventually enacted into law. Both the test cases for a restaurant and a hotel came from the city of Atlanta. They were expedited to the U.S. Supreme Court, and desegregation took place with the force of federal marshals.
Ivan Allen was also involved with another element that was very much a component, sports. Talk about the role of sports in the desegregation here.
Well, Atlanta had wanted to be a city of national importance since the days of Ivan Allen Sr. back in the 1920s. But with the Great Depression, with World War II and other things, we never could make it up on that municipal ladder from a city of regional importance to a city of true national importance. But during the decade of the 1960s, with Ivan Allen as mayor, one of his campaign promises was to bring professional sports to the city. This had been opposed by Bill Hartsfield, as progressive as he was on education and city too busy to hate.
Why?
He did not want professional sports because he thought it encouraged gambling. Mm-hmm. And so he would have nothing higher than minor league baseball. But Ivan Allen wanted to see the name Atlanta in national sports casts every day and in newspapers all over the country. And so he negotiated long and hard to finally bring the Atlanta Braves here, and then the following year to have the Atlanta Falcons football team. Both of these sports were desegregated when they started, and it was assumed that Hank Aaron was going to be a star in Atlanta as he had been in Milwaukee. And he did great things to bring blacks and whites together in our city. And then when the Braves were bought by Mr. Turner, he stepped forward and took an incredibly bold step by naming Bill Lucas to be the general manager of the Braves. And everyone that
first
general manager. First African-American to be a general manager.
Maybe the last? Has there been anybody else? I don't think there's been another black general manager.
But he was
in baseball.
He was not just general manager in name. He actually built the team that went to the World Series and did all
and
the
work. And he hired Bobby Cox.
That's true. So he did wonderful things.
And a whole bunch of good pitches.
We also had one other important first, and you mentioned Herman Russell and his importance in the city's business leadership. He also played an incredibly important role by becoming the first African-American in America to own a part of a professional sports franchise.
The Atlanta Hawks. What about Sid Scarborough, quickly? We should note him, Sid Scarborough.
He was
high school athletic director for Atlanta Public Schools.
He was the director of the City of Atlanta Public Schools, and he saw that desegregation was coming to the school system and that sports would have to play a role in that process. And so he began to call together black and white coaches and athletic directors from the individual high schools and begin the process of planning for the desegregation of high school athletics in advance of any requirement to do so. This was not always welcomed by the white coaches especially, but they had to sit with him and listen while they made their plans. Then when it actually became a reality, they started with non-contact sports, especially basketball and track and field the first year, and then the second year added football. And the interviews with those coaches who were part of that desegregation process were incredible to record in this book. So I won't give the stories away, but encourage you to buy a copy. Read that.
It's fascinating. It speaks to also the Muhammad Ali situation, where we allowed Muhammad Ali to box in Atlanta, which brought a great deal of attention. Andy, did you want to
speak? Yeah, no, that was Senator Johnson, Leroy Johnson. And Jesse Hill, and talking with Governor Lester Maddox.
Yes, Lester Maddox.
And I always felt that Lester got a bad rap. No, because the student sit-in movement voted to give, they say you have to give your opponent a face-saving way out.
Right.
And Riches and Woolworth and others are all, hotels are all ready to integrate. And the Committee for the Appeal for Human Rights actually voted not to attempt to integrate the Pickrick, Lestomatics, and Libs. They said, we have to give them some time to adjust. And there were three little trying to be militant preachers who said, no, we going down there, we gonna show him. And when they went down, when you go down, to, if you're gonna do that, and you go down and somebody comes after you with an axe and a gun, you're supposed to stay there and take the whipping. But when Lestomatics showed up with a gun and an axe handle, they hauled it. And that was the picture. But now, Lester was really accessible to Daddy King all the time. Daddy King always went to see Lestomatics. He and Lyndon, Leroy Johnson developed a friendship. He also had a Christmas pardon. Every Christmas morning, he had breakfast, and he had 300 or 400 prisoners that he gave a Bible, a sermon, breakfast, and a Christmas pardon.
Pardon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He let them out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
It was a get out of jail card. And now that we're talking about the effects of mass incarceration, Lestomatics was really very, very poor. I understand what he was struggling with in having put together a business with the eighth grade education and then thinking that it was going to be threatened. And he started that business to get his mother out of the house where because his father, working at Atlantic Steel, had an alcohol problem. And when you know people's personal stories, when I got to be mayor, before I was even sworn in, a fellow by the name of Fred Bennett called me up one Saturday morning and said, get up. I said, what do you mean? We got to go to Bremen. I said, Bremen what? Bremen, Georgia, what for? The speaker's wife died. I said, so? I don't know the speaker. He said, boy, you the mayor of Atlanta. You better know the speaker. Get up, I'll pick you up in 20 minutes. So we went over there and I said, look, I'm not used to this. Let me just stand in the back and be quiet and stay in my place. I don't want to disturb the funeral. When the speaker heard that I was back there, he got up from the mourner's bench, came back, pulled me by the hand, pulled me up to the front row on the non-family side, and there was and pushed Lestomatics and Herman Talmadge apart and set me down right in the middle.
Oh, my.
You know? And from then on, I had no problems with the legislature.
That's a great story, a great story.
You see what fun it has been to work with Ambassador Andrew Young and hear one of the master storytellers of all time at work.
It's that imagination, it's that creativity, and we speak
no, that was
to
real.
That.
And it's also getting the voice of the policymakers, because we're very hard on leaders, but we know that no one is perfect. But it is important for us to understand that people are what make these things happen. And so often, we spend more time on the critique than we do on the actual narrative of what has been accomplished. So we know that there are many problems that continue in the city of Atlanta. But when you look at the growth of this city from a city of less than a million to now, even in the time that we've been writing, it's gone from being the ninth largest to the eighth largest metropolitan area. And so there's something important happening. We're the number one destination for African Americans. When African Americans move somewhere in America, they move here. And that's very much the legacy of Maynard Jackson and changing the opportunity structure, that if you're a banker, if you have a major company in Atlanta, you have senior African American leadership, because in Atlanta, that is a norm and that is expected. And that was the leadership of Maynard Jackson to accomplish that.
Maynard's grandfather, John Wesley Dobbs, talked about The three B's.
Three B's.
The book, the ballot, and the buck. Those were the three elements he felt were necessary to uplift a people, mm-hmm. especially Black people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the mm-hmm. book is about the book, mm-hmm. education, mm-hmm. the ballot, mm-hmm. our voting power, and...
I warned Brooke that if she didn't write this herself, I was going to have to take it, because it is so much the story of Atlanta. The book, the Atlanta University Center, which after the Civil War began educating, you know, a highly trained, highly educated population, African-American population in Atlanta. In fact, Atlanta University awarded the first bachelor's degree of any institution in the city of Atlanta at that time. We the ballot throughout Atlanta's history, even before the Voting Rights Act, our African-American leaders were very strategic about using the vote to get what the community needed. Booker T. Washington High School, first African-American high school, was because the Black community voted down a referendum because there was no high school, and the negotiation turned that around. The same thing with the City Too Busy to Hate, the first Black police officers.
Right.
Atlanta had Black police officers in 1948.
After we delivered 10,000 votes to Hartsfield.
Because of the use of the ballot and delivering those votes to Mayor Hartsfield. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, Maynard came in, and it's about the buck. You use that political power to integrate the money so that now there is much more, you have more African-American businesses, there's much more participation in the economy. And then it becomes a virtuous cycle. So, you know, this is Atlanta, this is the city of Atlanta, the Atlanta Public Schools radio station. You have to get your lesson. There is no substitute for getting your lesson, doing your homework.
That's right.
Being a diligent student. That's the foundation of the rest.
The first voter registration drive I got involved in was in 1956, when I went to a voter meeting, I think in Macon, and John Wesley Dobbs said, would you lead a voter registration drive down in Thomas and Grady County? And I said, yes, I'd be glad to. He said, but we want you to make sure that everybody votes Republican. And I said, well, I was for Stevenson. He said, that was in Connecticut. He said, if Stevenson wins, Richard Russell names the judges. If Eisenhower wins, we're the only Black Republicans in the South. We get to recommend the judges. So I voted for Eisenhower, and the Black Republicans, every judge that made a positive decision in the civil rights movement in the 60s was an Eisenhower appointee that had been recommended by Black Republicans. And that's Frank Johnson from Montgomery, Minor Wisdom in New Orleans, Judge Tuttle here, Simpson in Florida. I mean, they were all the brightest and the best of the white lawyers in the South. And they were really some heroic figures who suffered greatly. I mean, Frank Johnson's family was under so much pressure that his son committed suicide. And they are the unsung heroes of the South, but they go back to the same story at Maynard's grandfather.
John Wesley Dobbs, actually, the three B's came mm-hmm. from him, but actually that was, originally it was mm-hmm. five elements. Mm-hmm. Before the book, the ballot, and the buck. Before the book was religion, mm-hmm. and following the buck was culture. Mm-hmm. That was his yeah. fifth element. And yeah. as a matter of fact, yeah. that's exactly what you talk right. about in right. the creative class, right. the arts, the culture, the media, right. and how that has impacted right. the growth in Atlanta.
Because as we, you know, Atlanta is about transportation, and you sort of say, well, what does that really mean in the 21st century? So, you know, it's about, so in the 21st century, Atlanta has really been exporting culture. You know, through Ted Turner and CNN, we're exporting that sort of vision of democracy through the Carter Center, through Dr. King, you know, that, you know, our hip hop music, I'm having to learn it. You know, Madea, Tyler Perry had number one movie this weekend, y'all, in America.
Yep.
You know, and so, but that really started with, in terms of the mayor's role with Maynard Jackson and having a cultural affairs.
Bureau of Cultural Affairs.
Being, so you attract, because in order to attract the smartest people now, you have to have a tolerant environment and you have to have the openness for that creativity. So, you know, the smartest people in the South walked to Atlanta. I mean, after the Civil War, and it's still happening. Because this is a place where people of tremendous diversity can use their gifts and use their creativity. The culture and tolerance is part of that.
We'll be back after this short break and continue my conversation with Ambassador Andrew Young, his daughter, Professor Andrea Young, and Professor Emeritus Harvey Newman about the documentary, book, and archival project, The Making of Modern Atlanta. Welcome back. This is your host, Valerie Jackson. Today, I bring you a special event we recorded at the Carter Center's Cecil B. Day Chapel. Let's continue my conversation with Ambassador Andrew Young, his daughter, Dr. Andrea Young, and Dr. Harvey Newman about the documentary, book, and archival project, The Making of Modern Atlanta. A social scientist, Richard Florida, I believe, mm-hmm. talked about three T's for mm-hmm. economic growth, mm-hmm. talent, technology, mm-hmm. and tolerance. Mm-hmm. Tell how those three mm-hmm. worked in Atlanta.
Well, we've got those three things, you know, really working. The tolerance goes back to Henry Grady, as we talked about, really saying Atlanta is a different place to northern investors. We have our educational institute, our Georgia Institute of Technology. We've got
Ted Turner's,
you know, CNN. We have this synergy going that's part of what is going to take us into the 21st century and continue to grow as a diverse community.
I want to ask, we've heard a lot of good things about the Atlanta Way. Harvey, can you tell me of an instance where perhaps the Atlanta Way, where there was a project that didn't succumb to the Atlanta Way and never happened?
One of the things that troubled me as we were writing this book was what I would call the persistence of poverty in our city. Here we had a mayor, first with Maynard Jackson, then with Andrew Young, who were determined, as you phrased it, to change the opportunity structure for minorities in the city. And yet that changed opportunity structure did not reduce or eliminate poverty. Now, there are some bright spots from that. We have the highest African American income level in Atlanta, much higher than the surrounding suburbs and also other cities. So we are important in that regard, but we still have, because Atlanta has been a magnet for African Americans from all over the country, many of those are not well-educated, talented people who can take advantage of a high-tech economy such as you were just describing. And for those people, Atlanta has remained a challenging city. And so one of the things that I think we face as a city is this persistence of poverty. I had a student ask me this week in class, is education the magic bullet to solve that? I wish I could say as an educator that I thought that could do it alone. But I think the persistence of poverty shows the limits of the leadership of a city in addressing problems. Because there are technical challenges, staging an Olympic Games, building a set of stadiums and so on, that are very, very difficult for a city to pull off. But our leadership of public officials and business leaders working in partnership has been able to do that. Unfortunately, that same partnership has not been able to address persistent problems of poverty. And I think that recognizes the fact that this is a problem of national scale and really has to be addressed and can't be done at the micro level of a city.
I want to argue that because I think we have. And I think that the people who grew up in the projects in the 60s and 70s are the professionals today. And we've had three evolutions in and out of the housing projects. And the same people who were leaders when Maynard was mayor were not still there. They had gone on to graduate schools even. But we were a city of less than 1 million people with 30% in poverty. Well, let's say 70% in poverty at one time. See, by the time we became 2 million people, that was another poverty generation that had come in. Now we're 6 million people. It's not the same people that are poor.
No.
So no, and now here's where we fail. And I'm meeting with a group of sociologists tomorrow morning. And I'm going to blame them because, and not blame, but just say, here's what happened. We passed all of these laws, like when we passed the Food Stamp Act, it was basically designed to help Midwestern farmers. So somebody tacked onto it an amendment that you couldn't have an unemployed man in the house and receive food stamps. Yeah. So you deprive the family of a father. So then we had Section 8, which was a good housing bill, which provided housing and integrated housing all over. But only the people who signed up for Section 8 could live there, which means that as they got older, their grandchildren couldn't live with them. Now, if you structure through national policy a family breakup that deprives children of the father and the grandmother, you've done more damage to the black family than slavery did. Then when you add on to that, and I've appointed most of these young black judges, and they start fining people for these traffic violations, and it's almost like the police and the judges have quotas, and they're making poor people pay for their salaries. And that's the sin of Atlanta right now. And we've got to find a way to directly deal with the problems of poverty. And I think I was with a conference in Dallas on mass incarceration. And it was run by a phenomenal group of women, all of whose husbands were in jail for petty things, little things. And we realized that the reason why they were in jail was state laws that were sent to the states by something called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange something. But they sent all of these conservative laws, mimeograph them and send them to all the states, and they send money and they send money to the state legislators who put them in. And so that's the worst element of, we've had a good relationship with corporate America here in Atlanta, but nationally that has not taken place. And so that's the next challenge, I think. And we have it the same schools. I do not want the states. In fact, it used to be Republicans that wanted the family to control schools. And now, you know, they want to take over schools. And the closer you keep education and religion to the family, and to a family that is cohesive from grandmama and grandpa to kindergarten as possible.
I wish we could import the Atlanta way, because there really are lessons to be learned from the making of modern Atlanta. And I'd like for you, Andrea, to quickly, because we're almost out of time, to speak to the lessons there. I think five lessons that you listed from the making of modern Atlanta.
Well, I think I appreciate that chance to finish with that we have really had a good discussion, you know, of them today, that we have a... You have to understand what it is that generates opportunity in your community. And for us, that's transportation in the broadened sense, moving people, moving ideas, moving culture around the world. You have to have leaders who really care and are willing to make sacrifices to make a difference for other people, philanthropic leaders, business leaders, political leaders. You have to have a strong governing coalition that knows what it is the city needs to prosper and work on that over decades. This is not something you can do in one term, but you know, really working over decades to make that happen. And you have to sustain that coalition with a vision to continue mentoring. You know, today our current mayor was mentored by Shirley Franklin. Shirley Franklin was mayor and helped and counts Maynard Jackson and Andrew Young. In fact, when we interviewed her, she wept thinking about the impact on her life that working with Maynard Jackson and Andrew Young had just created an opportunity for her to serve in a way that moves her to tears. And as she said, she never cries.
She did all the work.
That's why she was
but
crying.
But she said she learned, you know, she learned from you guys. So it, you know, this has been, you know, these have been our traditions. And being inclusive, moving from being a city too busy to hate to being a city that really is about inclusion, about love, about tolerance. I mean, what other city has beat back this notion of intolerance by having almost every Fortune 500 CEO sign and testify to say, no, in Atlanta, we are an inclusive and tolerant city. And that's why the Porsches are coming here. That's why Mercedes is coming here. That's why Delta is staying here. Is because they can bring anybody with any religion, any background, any ethnic group, any sexual orientation, and they have a home in Atlanta, and they have an embracing community in Atlanta.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we almost forgot that, because it was not automatic that Atlanta become an international city. And I think my being drafted from the United Nations and coming in at a time when there was no money in Washington and we had no place to look, actually Maynard and David Franklin and I went to the Middle East and stopped off in Europe on the way back just before I took office. And we made the first contacts telling people, look, we know you got money hidden all over the world, but they're charging you interest to keep it. That's stupid. I didn't say that. But, you know, it'd be much better for you to find a way to invest your money in Atlanta. And President Carter and I held a meeting down at the Hyatt, and we had more Middle Eastern businessmen you know, that had ever been collected outside of the Middle East. And all of a sudden, things changed. We got almost $1.5 billion of Dutch investment. That wasn't just Dutch money. Factories started moving here from Japan. We now have over almost 2,400 German companies. We have about 700 Japanese companies. We have Korean businesses. We have England. I mean, we, during the time I was mayor, those 8 years, we brought in $70 billion and 1,100 companies moved here from overseas, and it created 1 million jobs.
And it was through those cohesive coalitions that we talked about. As a matter of fact, Andrea, there's a section in the book, we were talking about it before we came in, that really kind of wraps this all up, and it has a strong ending. And so I'd like for you to share that with the audience before we close.
Okay. Thank you. The unique contribution of African Americans in art and entertainment, the Carter Center, the communication platform that was CNN, have all been critical components of Atlanta's ability to be a presence on the global stage. Among Atlanta's most significant exports in recent years have been its culture and values. The city's diversity has been its signature brand as Atlanta moved from rejecting hate to embracing difference, inclusion, and love. Atlanta has had no more influential cultural export than the vision of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the inspiration of his nonviolent movement to end racism, war, and poverty. Around the globe, when people stand for peace and justice, one can discern the influence of Dr. King. His anthem, "We Shall Overcome," was sung when the Berlin Wall came down. It was sung by the Solidarity Movement in Poland and during the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square protests in China. In 2011, an Egyptian human rights activist translated into Arabic a comic book on Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott for circulation among young Egyptians. King's legacy and vision are of the United States living up to its best and highest ideals, the true meaning of its creed that all people are created equal. In his lifetime, he expanded that vision to include all the people of the world. Accepting the Nobel Peace Prize on Human Rights Day, December 10, 1964, Dr. King said, "Sooner or later, all people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict, a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love." Emma Darnell, the first woman to head a cabinet agency in the city, reflected, "We have folk coming here from all over the world. It's an intangible something here that is basically something spiritual. I believe as long as we have it, we'll always be different, we'll always be stronger, and we'll always survive. You know, it's not the skyline, not the Olympics, not the Falcons, not the aquarium. It's that grave down there on Auburn and what it represents."
Amen. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me tonight, Ambassador Andrea Young, and Harvey Newman. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE-FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Christine Dempsey, Lois Reitzes, and Dave Baraswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation.